and welcome to the EU and You. I'm Ellen Gunning, and in this series, I hope to explain the EU and its most important institutions. There are four main institutions in the EU: the Commission, the Parliament, the Court of Justice, and the Council of Ministers. I'm joined in studio today by William Scally, who's worked in industry, who's worked as an advisor to the Irish government, and who now does public policy consultancy. And he's offered to explain the Council of Ministers to me. Thanks for coming in, William.
Thank you.
Let me begin with the most obvious question. What does the Council of Ministers actually do?
I suppose the short answer is that it meets, like all political institutions. I think it's just important to get the basic structure of the European Union in context, that, as you said in the introduction, you have the Commission, you have the Council of Ministers, and you have the European Parliament. And the key characteristic of the Council of Ministers is that it's where national governments operate. You know, the Commission is, in one sense, a type of civil service. The Parliament is an elected body of members of the European Parliament from each of the individual 27 countries. But the Council of Ministers is the formal institution where the 27 national governments engage in the discussions and decision-making on European issues. So it is the forum for national governments. The second point I would like to make about it is that, you know, none of these institutions really work in isolation. They operate sometimes in disagreement, but they operate as part of an integrated structure. And the Council is where, you know, national interests, you know, people, governments put forward their specifically national interests on European issues. Now, the Council of Ministers does a number of things. The Commission, as many people know, which is a type of civil service for the Commission, brings forward, you know, proposals for legislation and so on. And the Council considers these. The Commission, on the other hand, is looking at the European interest as a whole, whereas the Council of Ministers will look at European
each one individually.
As a whole.
But yeah,
they look at each country. How does this affect Ireland or Latvia or Estonia, what they're saying? I mean, this is where I'm responsible to. And so then the Council, you know, considers legislative proposals on the Commission. And it has to work, and increasingly so in recent years. In the older times, the earlier days of the EU, the Council of Ministers was very much, you know, in control of ultimate decision-making. But now, basically, it's shared with the European Parliament. There is a lot of what is called co-decision, whereby...
Just before we move on to that, just give me a handle on who's on the Council of Ministers. There isn't one actual council. So there isn't one representative who sits on the Council of Ministers.
No, there's... It depends on who the ministers are in each country, and it's basically organised by topic. That you have the Finance Council, you have the Agriculture Council, you have the Environment Council, you have the Transport Council, and the ministers who deal with these matters in their national governments, or their representatives, maybe junior ministers or maybe civil servants representing them, they are the people who participate in these, you know, individual councils.
So the Council of Ministers is actually 12 or 14 or 16 different councils, all devoted to different subjects.
Yeah, but when the need arises, I mean, you could be, if you're a member of the current government in Ireland, in 6 months' time, it could be a different minister, a new government, or as in the UK, where we've just had a change of government now in the middle of 2010. You had a transport council, say, or some council, say, in March. Well, it will be a new minister who represent the UK in September if they have the next council. So the councils tend to meet when the need arises, a few times a year. Now, I should have said, of course, that the Foreign Affairs Council is very important, and they do with general affairs. That's a very important one. And I think the other point to make, because there can be sometimes confusion about these things, that I think the treaties call what you're saying the Council of Ministers, Ellen, as the Council of the European Union. And then we have another entity, to make it confusing, called the European Council, which are the leaders of the 27 national states. And they meet usually twice a year. They deal with big questions with sort of giving leadership, we're trying to give orientation. Now, we may discuss that again later, but it's just important, I think, to have in mind that you have the normal type of legislative business by topic, which ministers in different governments deal with. And then you have the bigger forum of the European Council, which meets a few times a year, and which is presidents or prime ministers.
Yeah, and we would see a lot of photocalls from. So it's the one that Brian Cowen would go to,
that's
for example.
Right. That's the one Brian Cowen would go to.
And you would see Nicolas Sarkozy at it and people like that?
Exactly. That's right, yes.
Let me take you back again now just for a second. If you have all of these, let's say the Foreign Affairs Council, you have a Council of Ministers meeting. You have all of these ministers from each of the different countries. I would imagine it's very unwieldy if they're dealing topic by topic that comes before them. How do they, is there an awful lot of argy-bargy or negotiations, or does the commission, the civil service end, sort out an awful lot of the problem? Is it a rubber stamping, or is there really an awful lot of to-ing and fro-ing at those meetings?
I think that there can be, but I think that it's important to say that there is a lot of preparation. It doesn't. They don't just suddenly say we're having a meeting and we're going to decide on so-and-so. There will be a proposal from the Commission. The Parliament may have been involved. Interest groups will no doubt have been lobbying on whatever issue it's. The Council will come to take its decisions based on a lot of preparation. And in the formal sense, you have in Brussels, each of the 27 states has what's called a permanent representation. Ireland has one. There are permanent representation with the European Union. In the Irish case, these are civil servants who come from the main departments in Ireland.
Okay.
And they, you know, both watch what's going on in the other institutions, and they help prepare the appropriate Irish minister for council meetings. And it's you know, it's they talk to their counterparts. There is a, and we don't want to be having confusing type of acronyms. There's a body called COREPER, but it is fairly important. It's a body of these ambassadors, if you like, or representatives of individual countries, who meet every week, and they go through what's going on, and they prepare agendas for their council of ministers. They try to agree at times, you know, small things that when the council meets will be nodded through, and they try to clarify what each country's position is on the bigger issues. So
okay,
there is a lot of preparation, but there can be some very contentious things you see as well.
So really, by the time something gets to the Council of Ministers, it may have gone through, it may have started with the Commission, it may have gone through the Parliament. The Irish permanent representatives and the Latvian and the Estonian permanent representatives have all met and chatted with each other and in essence sorted out the less contentious areas. I'm probably simplifying that a bit, but they've sorted out the areas where there shouldn't really be cause for argument, and they've left the major issues for the Council of Ministers to discuss. And their job is, the permanent rep's job is to brief the minister before he goes into that Council of Ministers meetings and say, here's the position others are likely to take, here's the problem that France is having with that piece of legislation, or here's where we're coming from, here's the negative for Ireland. And that's really the main focus of the meeting.
That is it. That is exactly it. And of course, national governments and ministers will be lobbied. You take in, not so much maybe in recent years, but since Ireland joined in 1973, agriculture, for example, has been a huge issue. And you have the Irish farming organisations will have positions which they'll press on the minister. When you go to the council, you must get ABC. Then they will often follow the, and some of you may have seen this on television, the ministers, or be outside the ministers in Brussels or wherever it is, and they'll be pressing, we want A.
Yes.
So
yep.
There are all sorts of pressures on certain issues. This is not on
all
issue,
issues, yeah.
But on certain issues from interest groups and from you know, from public bodies in it could be in any country, you know. I mean, agriculture was always a big Irish one, you know. But there is a lot of preparation. The preparation thing is important. They don't just take decisions.
A quick decision.
You know,
yeah.
Except, And we come to that maybe when emergency things arise, you know.
Okay, but in the normal run of things, there would have been a lot of prep in advance.
A lot of to-ing and fro-ing between the Commission, the Parliament, interest groups, the Council, national governments. You know, everyone would have a view on it.
And when it actually ends up around the table, does everybody have an equal vote? How do they finally decide? Is it sort of one person, one vote?
No.
Okay. Okay. How do they actually decide then?
We have to make a distinction here, you know, that there are certain matters like taxation and matters of that nature which are considered so sensitive that there has to be unanimity.
Okay.
And other things like defence and so on are just outside this system altogether, you know. And then there are a large number of areas and an increasing number of areas where you have what's called qualified majority voting, QMV. And this is really a grading of countries in relation to population, but modified, you know, that they, in other words, the bigger countries have less than their population would entitle them to, and the smaller countries have more. And then there are certain threshold majorities, you know, you can't do it just on a straight 50%. It was somewhere in the region of 70% before Lisbon, and Lisbon then has the Lisbon Treaty, when it comes fully into operation, will modify it further.
So but, Germany so there is, would have maybe 20,
no, Germany
30
would have,
votes and Ireland would have six or seven.
Well, Germany would have more than that, I think. But you see, you have to remember that they try to do these things by consensus. That if Ireland has a vital interest, well, they may not like it. They may be able to vote it down, but they'll try to accommodate it. The European Union doesn't really work on the basis of saying, you know, we have the votes, you must do.
Okay.
In the end of the day,
stacked up on my side, I can win this vote.
In the end of the day, you know, the reason you have the qualified majority voting system is that if someone is so unreasonable that they'll hold everything up, that there is some mechanism for getting out of
it. To actually progress it along.
Progress it. Yeah. But they don't like, they don't like certainly on big issues.
So
they
as
don't
a general
like this.
Rule then they wouldn't vote. It would be pure negotiation and trying to find as many ways around everybody's problem as possible.
Yeah.
So that by the time they reach really a massive consensus then of 27 countries, depending on how many have an interest in that particular topic. Yeah. Is the qualified majority voting ever used then? Has it ever been used?
Oh, it has been used, yeah. Oh, they use it all right. It's part of the evolution of Europe in the last 25 years, the various treaties from the Treaty of Maastricht on and now in Lisbon. I mean, the areas where qualified majority voting applies have been extended.
And what kind of areas is covered by qualified majority voting?
A lot of environment, environment, health and safety at work, employment, no, parts of these areas. Mm. You see, it's very important, I think, to remember that national governments still spend most of the money in European countries, that the European budget is only 1% or so of what national governments of the GNP of the European Union as a whole, and most of the big spending decisions are still national decisions, but it is on areas connected with legislation, with harmonisation, you know, competition. Now, competition law is one where there is. That's an area where majorities, you know, where the community law fully applies. So there are parts of a lot of areas. So you know, it's not like saying the entirety of environment is done at Europe.
It depends
on what the treaties say. You see, because basically everything that is done by the European institutions must take account of the treaties.
Yes, because it all comes back been agreed by everybody at that point.
You see that the whole operation is an area where sovereignty is shared, where member states have agreed, as it were, to cede certain powers to European institutions. And in order to make it more effective, and gradually they've extended these powers. Now, there are certain countries that are very, very uneasy about this. We have been, Ireland, for example, has and successfully has been on defence and neutrality. We've great concerns there. I mean, the British are always uneasy about ceding powers to what they call Brussels, you know.
That's fair enough, but there are issues which almost historically, even people, voters in Ireland would have a difficulty handing over sovereignty, if that's the right expression, to Europe to handle defence and neutrality on behalf of Ireland. They're sensitive issues.
Well, they are,
and yeah, that makes sense that you have to kind of take that into account. You mentioned that the European Council is also capable of responding very quickly when they need to. They did that with the crisis in Greece. Give me a feeling for what they actually did.
Yes, I mean, this is important because our conversation so far has been stressing how long things can take and the interactions and so on. Now, maybe you could argue that how the EU responded to the crisis in Greece and sovereign debt, because it took a few months, took too long. But it's important that in the end, the Council of Ministers and the Finance Ministers and the sort of leaders in the European Union generally, they found legal ways, you know, in an emergency of addressing the problem and how they would organise and get funds together and work with the International Monetary Fund and so on. And they found maybe unusual ways. The Germans had problems with it.
They became quite creative, did they?
They became, under the pressure of events which they felt they had to deal with. Yes, I think it's fair to say they became creative and they got together and said, look, we have to do something. Now, it was maybe slightly complicated because we haven't discussed the Eurozone and that some of the countries, as we know, operate the euro, which is a common currency, and some such as Britain still have their sterling.
Outside of that zone, yeah.
And that was, if you like, a complication in this. But I think the point was that the European Union can sometimes, when necessary, act, you know, creatively and quickly, as well as all the slow stuff that goes on a different track, as it were.
No, that's fair, because that's actually what you would expect the leaders of each individual parliament to do. That should be the real skill. A, the big vision, fine, but B, that ability to say, no, this requires sort of an urgent meeting next week, sit down, heads around the table.
Oh, yes, people may remember reading about the German Chancellor, and they had problems because the Germans were very cagey about giving money out and so on. But in the end of the day,
they were very nervous and they felt that it was their money that they were giving out.
Precisely, yeah. But that was got over, at least in the sense that the situation in the short term has been stabilised, you know.
It's a good point to make, though, that generally they would seek consensus and move slowly. But when they need to, they really can react with.
Well, they got consensus, but they also moved quickly because the thing was, you know, the thing was pressing on them so much.
They had to. I'll bring you back to the Council of Ministers again and ask you just about this legislation or whatever comes before them. If they adopt it, that's fine.
Well, the Parliament has to normally agree it as well. You know.
But that's their sort of power of co-decision. So if the Parliament agrees it, then that becomes legislation.
It has to come from the Commission. The Council doesn't initiate it itself.
And what happens if something has been put before the Council and the Council says, no, actually, despite all the discussions and everything that's gone beforehand, we're not actually happy with that. There is an area here. We need you to, I presume they refer it back and say, we need you to look at this area again. We're not comfortable with it. What happens at that point?
Well, there are complicated procedures for readings of legislation and so on, and for interaction. I mean, the thing, in one sense, I suppose, goes around in circles. And the end of the day, they try to reach agreement. It may take years, you see.
I think that's what probably frustrates most listeners, actually.
Or it may be dropped.
So
it may be dropped because they say we can't agree it. And the Commission, the Council and the Parliament would have different priorities too, and they'll have different ways of looking at it, you know, of a particular problem. But it is fundamentally, I think, a process of interaction that you have the Commission looking at what they consider they're in duty bound under the treaty to look at the European interest, what in their view is best for Europe. The Parliament are elected from individual member states, and you will have different parties. The Parliament is grouped into parties. They will have different views, and the Council represents the governments. So you have to, they have to have a way, they have a way of interacting whereby they ultimately they can try to reach common ground.
It's a massive negotiating process, isn't it? It's really different to running a business where a businessman or a businesswoman says, thanks very much for all of your input and the decision now is X and we're running with it. Really, it's more like, it's almost like a trade union. Constantly we give a little, you give a little back. No wonder the system is so slow. Because the whole object of the exercise is not to alienate somebody and at the same time to move 27 countries forward, even if it's inch by inch in a particular direction.
I think broadly that's correct. You take something like greenhouse gas emissions, you know. I mean, they try to, if each individual country goes off and entirely does its own thing, it won't be effective. So they have to try to get the laggards on board for if they're to make progress on that and try to get public opinion with them. And you see, other things, you're right, of course, other things which countries do and saying, oh, it's Brussels that is imposing this on us. Now, a government might be quite happy that Brussels are imposing this on it, but it wants to be able to say that at home, you know.
But in fact, the government has been party to the decision at some stage in Brussels.
Yeah. And we're only doing this because it's what the majority want, and it would upset them greatly if we didn't do it. And, you know, will you please accept it? It's not our primary choice. So you're right about, you are referring back to electorates. I mean, the national governments are ultimately politicians, you know.
And they are all individual sovereign states. It's not like the US where they're all states which are part of one country. These are all individual countries. Let me ask you about the presidency of the council, because the presidency of the council, you have this council of ministers, which is the top tier, if you like, the European Council, is all of the Taoiseach, the prime ministers, mm-hmm. the leaders of each of the different countries. And then you have each of the different ministers on different councils. Mm-hmm. But the chair of all of those councils changes every 6 months. So each country takes a rotating presidency. Mm. How does it work? How feasible is it? Is there a huge amount of work in it? Yeah. Is it very much a ceremonial kind of thing?
No, that has been the case in the past. There are certain changes, certainly about the European Council into the future, which we can talk about in a minute. In the past, yes, and I've seen that, what normally happens, this is to, I suppose, originally to give each country a stake in how the Council of Ministers was run. I'd say you're correct in implying that it was not the most efficient way of doing it. But really what it meant was, say that the Irish presidency, Ireland has presidency in 1990 in 1996, in 2004, where the constitutional treaty was agreed. But normally there's a rotation, and say Ireland is due on the 1st of July. Well, Ireland will work with the country who has been there, done it for the previous 6 months. I mean, the Irish officials.
Just like a vice presidency or whatever.
Irish officials will be involved and will know what the agendas are and what, where things are at very closely. And similarly, the countries that are coming after Ireland will work with Ireland, so they'll know on the following 1st of January where to carry on from. So the countries coming before and after these 6 months do a sort of work. They certainly collaborate and keep each other informed on the agendas and on what's happening. And it does give the countries a stake. See, smaller countries like Ireland, who do it well, and Ireland have tried over the years, I think, the Irish Diplomatic Service and the Irish Public Service has tried to do these things well, and I think has succeeded in doing them well and in creating
that
impression.
That would certainly be the impression at home, that any time we've held the presidency.
Whereas big countries, some of them feel it's all a bit of a nuisance. You know, we're playing on a bigger stage and we have to go through all this. Now, that may be a little bit unfair.
Okay. But a smaller country... maybe that it means more to us and we really don't want to be seen to be getting it wrong.
Precisely. Yeah.
So we put more effort into it.
We put a lot of effort into
it. So a six-month presidency is really an 18-month
there's six months
leading up to it to know what's actually going to happen. Six months when you're chairing and being president, and 6 months handing over.
Yes, but as I said earlier, in the permanent representations in Brussels, they're doing an element of that anyway, because they're all meeting every week.
So that's ongoing anyway.
That's ongoing anyway, you know what I mean?
And you said that this was going to change now in the future.
Well, on the European Council, we've got, on Lisbon, we've got, as people may realise, we've now got... That used to be done on the same basis, really, as the Council of Ministers. But now we have a president of the European Council, a Belgian called Van Rompuy. He is now, the Lisbon Treaty has changed how the European Council works, in the sense that it's for 2.5 years, sort of permanent. In other words, that he's going to be convening and chairing meetings of heads of state for the 2.5 years starting whenever Lisbon came in a few months ago. And that is to try to give leadership. Now, it's very important that it's symbolic in one sense, but there's been some confusion. I mean, some people in the past have said he's president of Europe. He's not president of Europe. He's president of the European Council. You know, I mean, people can get, and it. You may remember too, there was politics involved with that. Do you go from someone for a big country like Tony Blair, or they eventually went for someone who is probably very competent, but from a small country,
and who wouldn't have the same high profile, and mightn't bring the same issues from their background?
Well, you see, this is part of the interaction in the EU that, you know, if they appointed someone to that job under the new Lisbon Treaty, you came from Germany or England, the smaller countries might feel a bit worried, you know.
If you appointed somebody who had a high profile in a national parliament beforehand, then they would have been representing that national parliament's view. So there might be a confusion that now they were expected to represent something which was somewhat different on behalf of Europe.
No, not really, because they do tend, and the same applies to commissioners, they do tend to appoint people with political experience. The commission, which is a different body.
So it's probably they're looking from a political background
Oh, yeah, they do, yes, because otherwise they'll be lost in this morass of that we've been talking about of European...
Okay, they'd be 2.5 years trying to figure out what was going on.
Yeah. Now, there was... I think it's always fair to say that they will tend to go for... I mean, it'd be great if he has business and other experience as well, but that they will look for someone who has political experience and understand what's going on.
Yeah. And the idea is then that position will change. Somebody new will assume that position every 2.5 years?
That's up to the national governments, yes. But I presume if he does well, he'll be reappointed. Yeah.
I presume it would seem more logical that if he's doing a good job, leave him there and let him continue to do it. Yeah. Will he also, you said that he's president of the European Council. Does his office also assume the presidency of the Council of Ministers then, or does that continue to rotate with each of the different countries?
Oh, in the short term, I think it's going to rotate, yeah, in the short term. I mean, ultimately, how Lisbon works out, they are trying to make these things more efficient. You know, in 10 years' time, how this will work is another question, really. But in the short term, we're having these national presidencies, yes. Yeah.
I think we'll have to have you back in 10 years' time to see what happened to the Council of Ministers. For the moment, William Scally, thank you for joining me.
Thank you indeed.
You've been listening to 103.2 Dublin City FM. This series was presented and produced by Ellen Gunning. Sound engineering was by David O'Grady. The series was made with the assistance of the Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe Initiative.